Yuga goes on. And Srila Prabhupada knew that. And he was urgent. His life was urgent to get this translation done. So he offered his obeisances at the start of the fourth canto. And this morning I was looking and I thought, I wonder when he wrote the fourth canto, when he translated it. And do you know, there's a letter from November 1968. He came in 1965. Where he's saying that he wanted them, would they be ready soon to print the third canto and the full fourth canto? In 1968, he had done this work. In 1969, he was speaking about how he had tried to get publishing done in India and it wasn't possible, and he'd lost the money because the disciple hadn't followed and gone to the right place and done the right thing. He said the money had been swallowed up, and there he is. He lost his typewriter. He lost this. He's poor. And he says, I require $50,000 immediately. Selling or not selling, I want to see these books published. This is my ambition. So he's asking for $50,000 and he has nothing. And now we see these beautiful books, so beautifully published. They've been meticulously edited for any English errors so that they read well, so a scholar will read them and say, this is an excellent translation. They have these amazing pictures that a group of devotees gave their lives for, to do the artwork. And they sit perhaps on our shelves at home. They sit perhaps here in the temple. And perhaps we don't pay them much attention a lot of the time because we're quite busy. We've got this to do and that to do and this to do and that to do and on and on and on in our schedule. And we offer them our heartfelt respect. But they should stay there and we should keep being busy. And so Srila Prabhupada himself, he said, if I have one criticism of my devotees, it is that they like to sell my books, but they don't like to read my books. And so that means that we don't become educated. And education in spiritual life, it doesn't just mean voluminous facts. You filled your head with all of this knowledge. It involves also a communion of heart. And that's why we need to hear together, because what happens is we hear something. And when we hear that one thing, it can affect us deeply. It can actually move around a few of our concepts of what's important and what's not important. Just by a phrase, just by a statement of the Bhagavatam. So here we are, and we're starting, as I mentioned, the fourth canto is about this secondary creation. So the first personality we meet, for those who are not familiar with the fourth canto, is we hear about Swayambhuva Manu. So we heard that the primary creation is done by the Lord himself. He creates all the elements. Just like if you want to build something, and you bring all the materials and say, here are the materials. And then you call this person, build this house for me. All the materials, I provided the materials, you provide the labor. And then he says, yes, yes, I can build this house, it's possible. And he gets involved, and what does he do? He calls other people under him. He says, I need your help, I need your help, I'll pay you, come here, and you together will build this house. So first there's Brahma. He's like the one who's going to create. Secondarily, primarily the Lord creates the elements. No one can create the elements. No brilliant scientist can answer the question, where did these things come from? Even if they create a new theory, every year they create a new theory. Every few years they create a new theory. But no one can tell you where the elements originally came from. A big bang? Where were they before the bang? If you think, if you just become a little thoughtful, you'll realize that there's flaws in the educational system. And so whilst we must learn and we must have a career and we must do something in the world, we should always take things with a grain of salt. Just as the materialistic person will take what we're saying with a big pile of salt. But we say, no, no, we're cultivating this understanding of truth. So we're not 100% sure if yours is right, but we have to pass our exams, we have to get our PhD, we have to do these things. So we will answer your questions, we will write what you want, and we will proceed with our lives. But inwardly, we will know that actually you know very little, very, very, very little of anything. And the Bhagavatam is profoundly deep. So Swayambhuva Manu had three daughters. Does anyone know the names of the daughters of Swayambhuva Manu? Oh, good girl. Akuti, Prasuti, and Devahuti. Devahuti. So in the third canto, we've heard already about Devahuti and her marriage to Kadama Muni and her son. Who was her son? Yes, Kapila Muni. We've heard of Kapila Muni's teachings. We've heard about Devahuti. So then as we continue through here, we start to fear. In the first chapter, it describes his daughters. In the first chapter of the fourth canto, describes the daughters of Swayambhuva Manu. Then in the next six chapters, it describes Daksha. So who was Daksha married to? Sati. Yes? Not married to Sati. Who was he married to? Prasuti. Prasuti. And who was his daughter? Sati. Exactly. And who was the husband of his daughter? Yes, Lord Shiva. So we hear about there was a bit of a disaster, family quarrel. There's a bit of an upset that took place there for Prasuti and her family. But by the mercy of Lord Shiva, everything ended, you could say, relatively well. And then we go on to hear of another descendant coming down through Daksha from Swayambhuva Manu, and that is who? Do you know? Who do we hear about next in the fourth canto? Dhruva Maharaj. Yes, Dhruva Maharaj. We did a puppet show of Dhruva Maharaj. So Dhruva Maharaj comes, and there's from chapter 5 to chapter 11 is about Dhruva Maharaj. And then after Dhruva Maharaj, we hear about King Prithu. So King Prithu, he's in the line of Dhruva Maharaj, who's in the line of Swayambhuva Manu. And there's many chapters, 11 chapters, about King Prithu. And now we come to chapter 22. And actually early in chapter 12, way, way, way back, when Narada is speaking, he's teaching about Dhruva Maharaj, he refers to the Prachetas. And he says that he had gone to the arena of the Prachetas and he had chanted these verses. And then he chants three verses in the Bhagavatam. And then all of this information is being heard by who? Vidura. And who's speaking to Vidura and telling him all this? Maitreya. So then Vidura, because he's curious, and Vidura would know all of this. This is all part of the Vedic culture. He would know all of this. But when an opportunity came to hear from Maitreya, he was so curious, as if he'd never heard any of these things before. So he asked about these Prachetas. Who were they? What were they doing? And then Narada, Maitreya, tells what Narada said next. So then comes the Prithu Maharaj. And at the end of Prithu Maharaj, then again we hear about the Prachetas. So Prithu Maharaj had one main son, he had two wives, he had four sons by one and one son by the other, and his main son was called Antardhan. He was given this name, it means something to do with darkness. Because when Prithu Maharaj was performing a sacrifice, and Indra came to disturb his sacrifice, this is quite fascinating actually. Indra is the head of the devas. Prithu Maharaj is an empowered incarnation of Lord Vishnu. And here's Indra meddling to try to thwart him from performing the full number of Asameda sacrifices. And so Prithu Maharaj, at first he was watching this, he kept stealing the horse. He'd steal the horse, and the horse wasn't there. And eventually the brahmanas who were performing the yajna decided to chant mantras to pull Indra into the fire because he was so mischievous. But it was the son of Prithu Maharaj who interfered. And he made peace between Indra and the brahmanas. And so Indra gave him the name Antardhan because he was sort of like in the dark. He arranged it all. So he wasn't very interested in rulership. He was a sadhu. And sometimes it happens in the Vedic tradition that a king has a son and his son is renounced and his son is not interested in all the headaches of Vedic management, all the responsibilities. So he established his sons as kings. And he had one son whose name was Havidan. And Havidan, he had another son and his name... His name was Barisat. And Barisat was so interested in performing yajnas, sacrifices, Vedic rituals that were meant not to please Hari, to please the Supreme, but to elevate him. He was interested in personal elevation leading towards the heavenly planets. And every time he would perform a yajna, there's an animal sacrifice would go on. And so he's actually accumulating for himself, because his yajnas are for himself. They're subtly or grossly motivated for his own advancement. And so each time he's killing an animal for the yajna, he's accumulating something. And so at a certain point, Narada thought, this Barisat, or later he's called Prachinabarisat, he said, he's in the line of Dhruva. He's in the line of Swayambhuva Manu. And look what he's doing. He's so religious. He's doing one ritual after another. He's going from this part of his kingdom to another part. It said that there were Kusagrats facing east for the yajnas all over his kingdom. So he's a good religious man, highly praised. However, he doesn't actually understand the purpose of the yajna, and he doesn't understand the purpose of life. And so Narada decides to go and pay him a visit. And meanwhile, Prachinabahi has these 10 sons, and each one of them is equally serious. Imagine if you had 10 sons and each one was equally serious. They didn't look left or right at anything. They served their father. They just wanted to do what he wanted. And he was so proud of his 10 sons. And so he knew, this was the culture, that they have to perform austerities in order to have the caliber to be a real king. Now, these Leelas take place in the Satya Yuga. When I was a new devotee, a young devotee, I would read here and it would say that this king, Prachinabahi, he wants his sons to go and perform austerities for 10,000 years. And I think that's unbelievable. 10,000 years? But when you take it into account that it is a different time scale, just as we can see on the higher planets, this way also there's a different time scale. Just like there are bugs who come flying in our window in the evening and we turn on a light, and by the morning they're lying dead on the ground. And that was their life. Their lifespan just passed. So in the same way, in the Satya Yuga, the lifespan is 100,000 years. So what is 10,000 years like? 10 years. So for 10 years they had to go away and they had to perform these austerities in relationship to their lives. So perhaps they were 10 years old when they had to go away, or perhaps a little older, but they had to go away and do this austerity to build their character. And so meanwhile, as he sends them away, Narada is planning to go and visit Prachinabahi himself and have a few words with him and sort of straighten out his vision, which isn't entirely easy, but Narada has his ways. And the boys go off, young men, they go off. Now the mother of these boys, the wife of Prachinabahi, is called the daughter of the ocean. So I can't unravel to you how the ocean has a daughter, but she's the daughter of the ocean. And so her sons choose to go to the ocean and perform austerities underwater. Again, this is a different age where by the process of yoga, Dhruva Maharaj stops breathing once a month or something, he breathes. So we need to have this understanding that this life, this world, our razzmatazz with our machinery and technology, this is just something. It's not everything. And there was such a history behind, and there will be so much ahead. And we should connect ourselves tightly to the Bhagavatam, because that will anchor us so that we don't get tossed around with the storms that will inevitably come in this difficult age. So the boys go off and they're going to the ocean to perform their austerities, and they go east, and west actually. And as they're walking along, they come to this incredibly vast body of water. It's just like the ocean. It looks like the ocean. They can't see any land anywhere in the distance. And they're looking around at this huge, vast area of water. And on their sides, on the bank of the water, there's these beautiful trees, all kinds of big, healthy trees, full of flowers and leaves, and they're vibrant. And they're looking and they say, this is beautiful. And there are birds in the trees, all kinds of birds in the trees. Mostly we probably hear about 4 or 5 birds if we're lucky. But there's so many birds, and there's water birds in the water. There's swans in the water, there's lotuses growing in the water. And they think to themselves, this is a wonderful place. We've come to a very, very beautiful place. And as they're standing there, looking around at the scenery, they see that Lord Shiva has come. And they're very, very astonished, actually, because they hear the drums and they hear the instruments and then they see Lord Shiva. And they're very fortunate to see Lord Shiva, and there's a description given of Lord Shiva. His bodily luster was just like molten gold. If you have ever seen gold, or even artificial gold plating from China, something, you imagine that pouring gold, glittering gold. His bodily luster was just like molten gold. His throat was bluish, and he had 3 eyes, 1, 2, 3. Which looked very mercifully upon the devotees. He was accompanied by many musicians who were glorifying him, and as soon as the Prachetas saw him, they immediately offered their obeisances in great amazement. They fell down at his feet. And Lord Shiva became very pleased with the Prachetas, because generally Lord Shiva is the protector of pious persons and persons of gentle behavior. is the protector of pious persons and persons of gentle behavior. This is how Vaishnava views Lord Shiva. It's rather interesting, actually. If you go online and you put Lord Shiva's name, it will take you to a multitude of websites, all sorts of websites, and you read what they think Lord Shiva is. And you'll read all kinds of things that they say. Lord Shiva is like this. Lord Shiva is formless, he's timeless, he's limitless, he's the patron of yoga, he manifests and unmanifests, he's everything. He's not limited to a person, he's the potential of life, he's all-encompassing, he's the universal consciousness. Now, actually, all those things are true. However, he's also a personality. This is the mysterious nature of transcendental personalities. They're full of qualities. They exhibit their energy in all sorts of amazing ways, but they're also a personality. And when we approach them in the correct way, we get reciprocation. Most people approach Lord Shiva, I'm sure so many of you are from India, you know what they approach Lord Shiva for. Give me this, give me this, give me this, give me this, take care of this, make sure that doesn't happen, watch this, on and on and on. A long list of material desires. But the Prachetas had been asked to perform austerity in the service of Lord Vishnu. And when Lord Shiva saw that, he came immediately. They didn't have to ask anything. And he was very, very pleased with them. And he said, "You are the sons of Prachinambahi, and I wish all good fortune to you. I also know what you are going to do. And therefore, I am visible just to show you my mercy." He says, any person who is surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, the controller of everything, material nature The controller of everything, material nature as well as the living entity, is actually very dear to me. So we should know that Lord Shiva is very dear to us and we are very dear to him. But we should always remain in the context that we are Vaishnavas. We want to serve Krishna. We don't want, give me this, give me this, give me this. Then he tells them how difficult it is to actually see him. How difficult it is. And then he says, you are all devotees of the Lord, and as such, I appreciate that you are as responsible as the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. I'll read that again. That's so sobering. You are all devotees of the Lord, and as such, I appreciate that you are as responsible as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I know in this way that the devotees also respect me and that I am dear to them. And thus no one can be as dear to the devotees as I am. Is Lord Shiva saying this? No one can be as dear to the devotees as I am. So then he says what we heard in the verse today. So we're going back and we're going to stop here, and tomorrow what we're going to do is go forward. The Rudra Gita is composed of 33 verses, and it can be divided rather simply into three sections. So we will start to hear something of the Rudra Gita tomorrow. So I will read you again the verse that we were hearing today. Now I shall chant one mantra, which is not only transcendental, pure, and auspicious, But it is the best prayer for anyone who is aspiring to attain the ultimate goal of life. When I chant this mantra, please hear it carefully and attentively. So I'll stop here, and if we have any questions, please ask them. Yes, Sweta. Coming.
King Prachinabhavishad was microphone. Not really a devotee of Krishna, but was more religious.
Yes.
But on the other hand, his sons, Lord Shiva, recognized them as devotees of Krishna.
Yes.
So it's very interesting because normally you will have... it's interesting how the father was not a devotee, but the sons were... So,
but I think Narada saw the father as dormant. And there's probably many dormant people in the world. And if you wake them up, all of a sudden, they become devotees. And you think, where did that come from? And it's because they're dormant. So we're also a bit dormant, have you noticed? So we're also kind of, that's why we're interested in Lord Shiva's, is he going to shake us a little bit and wake us up a little bit? Yes. His sons, he was fortunate, 10 sons, and they were less dormant because they were obedient to him. And he told them what to do, and he told them to do something of value. So we must also carry that on with our little ones. Yes. Hare Krishna. Antardhan. That wasn't his birth name. You'll have to look it up in the fourth canto. Yes.
How is Kshatriya's
face used? Well, it's part of the Vedic ritual. Uh-oh. It happens, Sweta. It happens sometimes. That's what happened to me when Gaur and Atai were being installed. At least you're not a demon. We'll give you time. Yes, it happens. Now, kusha grass is used in Vedic sacrifices, and it seemed as though you had to have it facing towards the east. There were so many rules involved, so many rituals. You have to do this, you have to do that. You have to test the mantra on an animal, and if the mantra, if it's not chanted properly, the animal will get... If the mantra is chanted properly, the animal will get back their life. If the brahmanas do anything incorrect in chanting the mantra, the animal would die. So it's part of all of that. It's part of what they had to do the sacrifices. Good questions. Any more? Yes.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much for a wonderful class. As you emphasizing on, please chant carefully and attentively, what does this mean, like, while practicing chanting? Carefully and attentively.
What does it mean to chant carefully and attentively?
How to do that?
That's a question that everybody here will probably want to know the answer to, including myself. Well, I would say in the ideal is, it means that you should be listening to the sound of the mantra. That's the ideal. That's the benchmark. Probably most of us find that most of the time we can't do that. So then we come down to the level of dutiful. This is spontaneous, and now we come to the level of dutiful. So you should find a set time of the day to chant. You should try to make an environment around you that helps, a peaceful environment, either some place in your house or somewhere that you work at creating an atmosphere there, especially if you have a temple in your house. That's very helpful. And then you should sit or stand, whatever you need to do, for a certain amount of time and try to chant responsibly. And you should try, some people like to do a few breathing exercises before they start to calm down their mind, which is going everywhere. You find your own process that helps you. And the process should assist in your chanting. And then you try your best to chant in the mood of calling out to Krishna that I need help. I'm not doing so well and I need help. Rather than thinking, oh, this is just something I have to do, it's a routine. But please engage me in your service is the plea that we're asked to focus on. So that has many layers of meaning. So initially it may be, please give me something to do. And then it may be, please give me something to do that will nourish my appreciation and understanding of the devotees or of the deities. Please give me something to do for the deities. Please give me something to help me understand Srila Prabhupada. He came, I wasn't there, or maybe you were there in another body. So please give me some service. That's what the chanting is meant for. Yeah. Yes.
Harishna Maji, thank you for the wonderful class. My question was, you said, the scientists can never know the origin of this whole world by making theories. And
yes.
So then how do we preach to them about the, Krishna created all the material world, because they think it's all mythology and all that?
I think it takes a very, very trained person to actually preach to them. If we talk to them, we'll sound silly, because they have a language and they've done, Srila Prabhupada explains, they've done a vast amount of austerity to learn what they've learnt. His complaint is that it's like if I'm sitting, there's the door there, right? If some horses were outside and they're galloping along here, they gallop past the door and they keep going and the door's open. I've seen them as they went through the door. Now I've studied that very carefully. I worked out how fast they were going, what they were doing, where their eyes were blinking. I've done a lot of study and research on that part. But I have no idea about this part, where they came from, galloping along. I only saw that part. So he would say, that's what the scientists are like. They've put so much effort in, and some of them, of course, are quite demonic, because they're determined to show that there's nothing beyond science. But a serious person studying is genuinely trying to understand the truth, but they don't know about where the horse came from, and they don't know where the horse went, because it's not visible to them. This is all that's visible. So when you try to defeat them, you'll find it's very hard, because they have done some work on this part, more than you. They know more than you about that, but you know more than them about that. So you have to work out your own method of, but mostly I think it's not so easy to try and defeat a religion that's worldwide, because Srila Prabhupada would talk about science as becoming the religion of Kali Yuga. Meaning religion means I have faith in this, I believe this, I was taught this, and this is how you do it, and my religion doesn't have a god, but everything else is there. So, good luck.
Thank you.
What attracted you to this section?
Good question. I was wondering that myself. I'm just trying to think back. I think I was just moving through the Bhagavatam looking for something to share with you all. It helps me if I can come with something prepared, because I have time in Perth to prepare, rather than having to do it here. And if I read a specific verse, I have to have some research into what it's about. So I think I found Dhruva Maharaj, and then from there I found the Prachetas. And this is, I always think if there's something I don't understand, like Prachetas. Who are the Prachetas? Like, who are they? I mean, we say these names, but we don't know who they are. Then I'm a bit curious. I'm a curious sort of person, so I'll start looking up the Prachetas. Who are they? And then from doing that, I found this song of Lord Shiva. Oh, and it also, I wanted to share it because so many of the devotees are from an Indian background. And so they have their own conditioning about Lord Shiva. Oh, and also I was reading in a book about Lord Shiva, and I found Lord Shiva was very interesting. And so that also attracted me to Lord Shiva. That's interesting. Because I know if you go out into the world outside and talk about Lord Shiva, as I go on the internet and you find out, they believe that Lord Shiva is God, he's everything, and everything else is not real. It's very interesting. Tomorrow I'll ask you to tell me the positives of impersonalism. All the positive values of impersonalism. Because it's a very popular theology, and you should know why it's popular. And then you have to look at the positives of personalism, and you'll see that there's some things about personalism that are uncomfortable, that make impersonalism much more attractive to the ordinary person. It's good to know that. So that's Lord Shiva's department. So I was curious. Thank you. Yes.
Hare Krishna, Mataji. Hare Thank Krishna. You for the nice class. Mataji, you mentioned that whatever we're studying at our schools is very different to what we see here in Srimad Bhagavatam. But again, we have to answer the questions based on what they've taught us so that we can pass the exams. Although we know that they're not right. So I'd like to ask, we are encouraged in schools to get a good education, good job, and a good package of money so that bhakti can be easier, because without money, bhakti is a bit difficult.
A little bit.
So what should we do to stay on the right path? Because I see for myself, I get 2 to 3 hours maximum to read the Srimad Bhagavatam, and in school we stay with the teachers for 8 hours every day. So
you have to hold on to the guidance of people who have already crossed that river. pardon me. People who understand, yes, this educational system is part of the Kali Yuga. It's meant to push people away from spiritual life, and it's very effective. And so we see oftentimes that when young girls and boys your age, they're this age, they're very interested in Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna and so on, and when they get to university they feel like, oh, nobody here's interested in that, everybody here's interested in this. So maybe I should also put aside my things and go over this way. And even Srila Prabhupada speaks about, interestingly, how he put his deities away when he went to university. Not that he put his faith away, he didn't lose his Krishna consciousness, but he put the deities aside for a certain amount of time, and then they came back very strongly. So he became a little busy with his studies. He had to pass his exams, he had to do things like this. And his father was watching him all the time. His father knew he needed an education, so he was prepared for that, but he was watching his spiritual advancement at the same time. So you have to, if you have parents who are watching you, you have to listen to them a little bit when they say, what's your name?
Sivia.
Sivia. Sivia? Sivia. If they say, Sivia, come a bit to this side, you're going a little too far to that side, you have to listen to them. And if they're not your parents, they're other devotees who are caring for you, looking after you, then you have to try and trust them to balance again. So that by the time you finish your university education and you've got a job and things are running for you in your life, you can increase your Srimad Bhagavatam from 3 hours to 4 hours. What do you think?
Thank you.
Yeah. Does that make sense to you, Sibir?
Yes, Mataji. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. When we hear the children ask questions, it's very, very valuable because they don't have the filters that we have as adults. So they're simple.
May I make a comment for better or worse?
For worse. Go ahead.
Okay. So, since I was a little girl, I always wanted to draw and paint. Although I grew up in a religious school, I always had to distill the essence of what was going on around me and use that as fuel for my true goal. So perhaps you could try that too.
And this is very interesting, Rasa, because she went to a religious school, she wanted to draw and paint, but she's not in that religion anymore. She's a Hare Krishna. What happened?
Still drawing and painting.
Yeah. Exactly. So Rasa's point is that she was so determined to draw and paint. And her desire to draw and paint brought her to Krishna consciousness. So we shouldn't worry too much if we have to go out into the world and get some education and some qualification, but you should have an idea what you'd like to do with your life. And then if you walk through, it's like if you're going to your friend's house and you're walking through a street and you don't know anything about this street, you're not confused because you know I'm going to my friend's house, so you're not thinking, look at that house, look at this house, should I stay here, should I go here? No, I'm going to my friend's house. So you have to have that determination, as Rasa had it in relationship to drawing and painting. Thank you, Rasa. That was very interesting. Any other wonderful comments? Yes.
Hare Krishna Mataji, thank you for the class and all the care that you put into this class. Just a really quick one.
Yes.
How come Lord Shiva's got this molten gold complexion when he's otherwise depicted as like dark blue?
Well, it's interesting because Srila Prabhupada says in the purport that mostly Lord Shiva's depicted as white. And I was thinking, white, usually he looks this darkish colour. But in other descriptions of Lord Shiva, it describes that he's a pale complexion. And also you should know that there's different manifestations of Lord Shiva. He's one, he's not different, but there's 11 Rudras, different forms of Lord Shiva that perform different tasks, but they're all also Lord Shiva. So here he's appearing in this lustrous, special way. Also, Lord Shiva has a manifestation called Sadashiva in the Vaikuntha region. Lord Shiva is a manifestation of Lord Vishnu. So he's not outside of our Vaishnava theology. But if you meet him down here and you don't know about his roots, you might say, oh, he's just this. But if you trace back to his source, he's actually a Vishnu form in the form of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is the glance that goes towards the material world. He's the one that impregnates all the jivas into the womb of the Maya Shakti. He is between Lord Vishnu and matter, is Lord Shiva. He's a very mysterious person.
Thank you.
We can talk more about that as we're going on.
Awesome.
Yeah. Any other? Yes.
Thank you so much. It's a beautiful class. The thing is, following Rasanandi Mataji's question,
yes.
Yesterday one devotee, she's beginning to come to temple regularly on Mondays, and she says she has so much time spending her research work, so how can I tell her to use that research work into Krishna consciousness?
Make friends with her. Make friends with her first.
She's very resistant, very... Yes. She is very particular into what she wants to do, very resistant. Yes. Yeah.
You see, if you don't make friends with her, and she likes you, trusts you, and so forth, it's hard to change somebody's taste. Because they'll just think, well, that's your idea, this is my idea. But if they trust you, then they will listen to you. And if they'll listen to you, then you can influence her to adjust things. If the family and friends are very resistant, you can't preach them very easily. But again, the same thing. If they see that you're very happy and you're doing well, sometimes it happens a time comes in their life where they have some difficulty and they'll turn to you. And you'll be very surprised because they've been watching you and they've been seeing that you're actually a devotee and you're a nice person. And they're having a problem. They think again, also, maybe I should ask her, maybe she can help me. But family are the hardest ones. Because they're the closest and they're always there, right? So they're looking at everything and they know you before, they know everything. Hare Krishna. Yes, Jai Sachi. Hare Krishna. Not 50 years ago.
Almost.
You have to ask her how old she is. I think she's here somewhere. Is she?
You said that was in 75, am I right?
75, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, let's not talk about 50 years. Ladies don't...
So I was just thinking, because we have a lot of kids.
Yes.
This is a society which is mostly now made of grastas.
Yes.
Probably next time when you come, you can actually give a session on where you were, how you actually progressed to where you are now, so that we can all learn from your experience, how to raise the kids, how to give them in Krishna consciousness. And a lot of people would like to be where you are now, and it will be actually a nice way to actually learn from your experience.
Well, the only thing that I would raise as a doubt in what you're saying is that the circumstances under which we raised our children, first of all, are not present anymore, they're not current anymore, one. Two, that we made lots of mistakes in raising our children. And a lot of the children were injured by the mistakes we made. So it's not easy for me to say, this is the way you raise your children. But I would say that the most important thing is that the parents continue to grow, both as devotees and as people, and that they become gradually more and more wise. And that takes time. That's not a formula, you know, that we take 3 tablets and... You know. So I don't mind speaking about my own experience, but I don't see my experience as an ideal model for others because the times have changed. You can still, I'm sure they could learn many things. I'm not denying that point, but that's perhaps my response.
Yeah, because in the beginning I know a lot of mistakes were made, you know.
So many.
So many. And... even going through those mistakes, now with that knowledge, what we did, what we shouldn't have done, so the next generation don't do the same thing.
We can ask our children to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they can say, well, this was very hard. When you did this to me, that didn't work. Yeah. And then we can hear from them. Sometimes that really will help parents to avoid what they feel is the best thing, I thought was the best thing, and then later on the children tell you, that was horrible when you did that.
Yeah, we hear that all the time, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I remember being here in Melbourne actually with my daughter and son, and my son was around about 9 years old and he was very restless, he was playful, and when he was in the Vrindavan Gurukula he was, you know, structured. But in the summer when we would come here to Melbourne and stay, he would run and run and run. And I remember telling him, you must chant japa, and and bringing him in here and telling him you must chant japa. And he would look at me and say, I will never chant japa in my whole life. Because we forced him, you know, he wanted to play and I didn't know what else to do. What else makes you Krishna conscious other than chanting japa? But he was too young to take that as beneficial. So sometimes we force our children into a mold and we think that that's good for them. But later when they grow up, they'll tell you what they thought. I'm sure we've all had that experience. Yeah. All right, I think we should finish. Another question?
Follow up to that one. That is also like the parents can do according to what the knowledge they have, they can do their best. And the thing is, Krishna also arranges, right? So the children serve the knowledge, forgetfulness, and
remembrance. Yes. Yes, depending on him. Yes. So if you depend on him, when you're dealing with your parents, if you depend on Krishna, then he may give you the inspiration what to say to them, most definitely. And he may give them the opportunity to actually hear you as well. Okay. There. Confirmed. All right. I think we should stop here with the kirtan. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Hare Krishna. Ahem.